With unprecedented geopolitical tension combined with a loose monetary policy, both the equities and the precious metal sectors have felt the heat. Here to provide insights into our extraordinary times is John Rubino, a best-selling author and manager of DollarCollapse.com. He also co-authored The Money Bubble with Gold Money's James Turk. In this hard-hitting interview, Mr. Rubino characterized our present economic resilience as a simulation. By borrowing money, you receive the benefits up front. However, at some point, the bill has to be paid. That's why you need to go right now to crushthestreet.com/goldbook, where we've laid out a strategy to protect your wealth. Remember, with record debt levels rising exponentially, this simulation will eventually collapse. So please go to crushthestreet.com/goldbook. So without any more delays, here's John Rubino.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into crushthestreet.com. I'm joined today once again with the world-renowned John Rubino of DollarCollapse.com. He's a welcome returning guest. Haven't been on the show in feels like some time now, but he's someone I've always respected and have learned so much from throughout the years. He's articulated things for me and connected a lot of dots for me regarding the economy, regarding, you know, why manipulating the economy is bad, who it hurts, who it doesn't hurt, who it helps, and just unveiling the propaganda in ways that have, again, connected so many dots for me. So I appreciate him coming on the show. John, thanks for coming on Crush the Street with me today.
Hey, Kenneth. Yeah, it has been a while, huh? But we waited until there was a lot to talk about. So this worked out fine.
Well, we're deep into the tooth of a very extended bull market. Stocks have been really choppy. And, you know, Trump wants looser monetary policies, and he hasn't been shy about making that known with his Twitter handle. And, you know, it's almost like, where does the Fed stand? Are they doing a good job of managing the economy for Trump? Do they do their own thing? I mean, there's so many things to discuss here, and I'd like to pick your brain on it. But, you know, let's start with, you know, the Trump presidency as it pertains to the markets. What's going on at the moment?
Well, you know, it's funny. Trump seemed like, and he certainly seemed like to most people in the mainstream, as this aberration. You know, he was going to come along, he was going to have four crazy years, and then he was going to get voted out of office and disappear without a trace. And then things would go back to normal. But he's turning out to be a very consequential president, for better or for worse. The big tax cut thing, for instance, is probably what bought us two more years of expansion. You know, you can simulate prosperity by borrowing a ton of money and spending it, right? Because you get all the benefits up front, and the problems with having to pay your debt back don't come along until later. And so we did that. We 8 or 9 years into a recovery, into an expansion, we borrowed a bunch of money, did a big tax cut. Now we've got $1 trillion deficits for as far as the eye can see. And the economy is holding up. There are those who say it's booming. If you look at some anecdotal evidence in the labor market, it seems really tight, like we've got a fast growing economy. And there are other things that you can look at that make it look like it's weakening already again. But in any event, this is the longest expansion on record now. And a big part of it is due to the fact that the Trump aggressively eased fiscal policy and has been jawboning monetary policy towards ease in a way that no president has ever done at the top of a cycle. Now, I wouldn't say that's a good thing, because downturns happen for a reason. You know, you need an economy to pause and flush out the bad debt that's taken on. You build up malinvestment the longer an expansion continues, and that malinvestment is like poison in the bloodstream of the economy. You got to get rid of it. In other words, all the loans that never should have been made, the factories that shouldn't have been built, the office complexes that aren't generating enough cash flow, et cetera, stuff that happens that shouldn't happen. In a recession, they go out of business, and they change owners at lower prices, and it sets the stage for a recovery. we're not doing that. we're continuing to chug along, building up more and more malinvestment. So Trump's role in this is arguable, but I think the fact that we're running huge deficits is contributing to this late stage growth. And, you know, it's good for the political party that's in office. It's good for people who are getting raises at work right now, but overall it's not good for the economy because it builds up more and more imbalances that have to be flushed out more and more painfully later on. So another 2 years of expansion, most people would say that's a good thing, but I would say the resulting recession eventually will be way worse. You know, you should have a downturn every 6 years. That's the historical norm. And that is about the right length of time for an expansion to continue. So we're late in the game, and I don't see it ending well, although I don't necessarily see it ending right away either, unless there's an external shock, which we could talk about next if you want. There's a lot of possible external shocks out there.
So I definitely want to get there, but one of the things that are at the top of my mind is, to what degree is the Fed on Trump's side, or is the Fed operating autonomously for the benefit of the banks, the elites, and those behind the private organization? Or what are your thoughts on that? Is there any sort of collusion to a degree where one, you know, because it can be political in many ways, you know, and it's like the Democrats versus the Republicans, but yet you have the Fed, which is kind of on their own to a certain degree, or are they? So anyways, any thoughts on that as it pertains to Trump, the Fed, and managing the current economy?
Well, I think we have to get past this idea that the Fed is one thing, the federal government is something else, and the big banks are something else yet again. They're actually all part of the same organization right now. They've over the past 30 or so years, since we've been on a fiat currency system, they've merged into basically one big thing whose goal is the continued accumulation of power and centralization of power. So for the Fed to lower interest rates in a way that helps the big banks and corporate CEOs and the federal government is no surprise at all, you know, because it's a division in that greater organization. And for corporations to borrow tons of money and buy back their own stock to push up the stock market, no surprise. And for the big banks to behave the way they behave. In other words, to give huge amounts of money to rich clients so that those rich clients can go out there and do rich guy stuff. That, no surprise to any of this. This is how it works in a big organization where different divisions are trying to work together to achieve a common goal. So the net effect of this is steadily increasing debt in the system at every level of society. You know, the governments of the world are taking on more and more debt year after year, after already taking on record levels of debt previously. Individuals in most major societies now are being, let's say, tricked into taking on huge amounts of debt by super low interest rates. You know, an interest rate is the price of money. So when you lower the price, more people take advantage of that and borrow. So corporations have record debt levels. College students have record debt levels. Auto buyers have record debt levels. Credit card holders have record debt levels. Mortgage holders, not record, but still high levels of debt. And the strange thing about this is that the idea seems to be prevalent among the guys pulling the strings that you can keep doing this for a while. In other words, you generate a boom based on debt, and when that boom goes bust, you cut interest rates dramatically, and then generate an even bigger boom based on even more debt, and so on forever. That's what it sounds like they think can be done. But really, each time you build up an even bigger amount of debt, it takes lower and lower interest rates to bring you out of the resulting recession/depression. And around the world right now, there's a ton of negative interest rate debt out there already. There are a couple of major governments that have negative short-term reference rates. In other words, if you want to lend money to the Japanese government, you got to pay them for the privilege. Same thing with the German government. U.S. interest rates are historically very low, although they're a little higher than they were 3 years ago, but they're still really low historically, which means that in the next recession, which will be big because of how long the recovery has run and how much debt we've taken on, we're going to have to push interest rates even lower. So the question becomes, how low can you go with interest rates without them turning into the problem rather than the solution? And we're going to find out, you know, in the next recession, Germany and Japan obviously will have to cut interest rates into the negative 2 or 3 or 4% range. The U.S. is going to have, because remember, the Fed normally cuts interest rates by about 500 basis points or 5 percentage points. So, you know, if interest rates are 7%, we go down to 2%, that kind of thing. So if interest rates now in the U.S., the Fed funds rate is 2%, and we need to cut rates by 5%, that means we're going to negative 3% for short-term U.S. rates. Now, what does that do? Nobody knows. The guys who are making these policy decisions either haven't thought this through or they're not worried about it. Now, I think both of those are equally likely because it seems like they live very much in the present at the monetary policy level in the U.S. They just do whatever they have to do to get through the next corporate reporting period or the next election cycle. But it's possible that if they're planning ahead for this, that they've got some real interesting surprises for us. In other words, banning cash or indexing mortgages so that your mortgage rate doesn't go to negative levels. You know, if you've got a adjustable rate mortgage or if you're taking out a new mortgage. In other words, your loan interest rate goes up along with the inflation rate, so that the banks you're paying back don't get stiff. Who knows? You know, there are things that they could do and that have been done in the past. Oh, and capital controls and price controls, of course, because extremely low interest rates are inherently inflationary. And if interest rates are, say, negative 2% and everybody pulls their money out of the bank and then buys real assets with that money, things that governments can't inflate away, you get inflation in the real asset sector of the economy. And then what will the government do about that? We don't know the answer to any of these things. And that's what makes this such an interesting time for economic theorists. In other words, from a theoretical standpoint, we've never tried this before. So we're doing this new experiment, which is fascinating, but it's also really dangerous because the experiment could easily blow up on us.
Yeah, completely unprecedented.
Yeah, completely. Well, actually, partially unprecedented. We've had negative interest rates around the world, and they didn't blow anything up. But now we have to go to more deeply negative interest rates. So presumably, there's a negative interest rate that is like a brick wall where you can't go beyond it. They used to think of the zero bound, what economists called it, as the line you couldn't cross. In other words, you couldn't go negative with interest rates, but we did, and we got away with it. So now maybe it's 2% or 3% or 4%, or maybe there's no limit to how low interest rates can go. And that's what we'll find out. But I would say that just the idea that we have to lower interest rates from here would make real assets, things that the governments can't just create on an electronic printing press or will into existence, more attractive. So we'll see a pendulum swing where we move money out of financial assets and into real assets. That's probably one of the side effects of what's coming.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a really interesting time here. And I know we were going to talk about some of the craziness that's going on around the world, obviously potential wars, the trade wars that's coming up. And I know to a certain degree, Trump is trying to backfill some of this bubble scenario that's going on. And maybe we can kind of start that question off with, can we backfill the situation, this unsustainable situation that we have by attracting capital from around the world through different avenues, whether it's tax cuts, attracting businesses into it, trade wars, tariffs, maybe a decimation of an actual war, you know, hurting other countries. I'm not advocating for that, but are these ways to backfill the manipulated bubble that we're dealing with at the moment?
Well, if it was just us, the answer would be maybe. Because in times of crisis, the US dollar actually gets strong. Even if we're the center of the crisis, it scares the rest of the world more than it scares us, because the rest of the world is more fragile than the US is. So we can have a problem here, which causes the dollar to go up, because it makes people even more nervous about French debt or Chinese debt or Japanese debt. So they buy dollars. Having said that, it's not just us. You know, the whole rest of the world is a mess. And if we do something that destabilizes the rest of the world, it's possible that their problems become so big that it swamps the capital inflows that we might see. You know, China quintupled its debt from 2008 to 2016. That's a huge amount of new debt to take on, and it's giving them kind of a mini credit crisis on top of everything else. They've got a lot of their shadow banking system that's seeing higher defaults, with nobody really knowing who has what money where. You know, they don't tell the rest of the world what's going on in the opaque parts of their banking system. So we don't know what any of this means, but it could be pretty serious just because of the numbers. Europe is a mess right now. Between virtually no European country other than Germany being able to limit their deficit spending, and a lot of European countries really needing a weak currency in order to function, the Eurozone is in grave danger. The Euro common currency is in grave danger. Japan, of course, just is a demographic time bomb. Its population is aging dramatically, and its debt is soaring at the governmental level. So if Japanese interest rates go up even a little bit, the government's bankrupt. So all of that stuff could be accelerated by a problem with the US. You know, let's say we get into a war with Iran and oil spikes to $100 a barrel. We're a big producer of oil, and we have all our military contractors who make a fortune from a war with Iran. So we're not fundamentally hurt by that necessarily, but the rest of the world is traumatized by it. And it's not clear that we come through that in flying colors. See, that in the past, there have been lots of monetary screw-ups that led to currency crises, that led to hyperinflations. But it was always one country at a time in the context of a sound money world. And this is now a fiat currency world where everybody has basically an unlimited credit card, and they're all maxing out those credit cards, taking on immense amounts of debt, which makes everybody really fragile. So there's no way to know, absolutely no way to know, what happens when trouble starts in one place. Because in the past, where it would have been contained pretty easily, now it can metastasize in no time. You know, dominoes can start falling in a way that even the Fed cutting interest rates to -2% or the US government running a $2 trillion deficit can't stop. And that should be the big worry for policymakers right now, is that this stuff starts and it can't be gotten under control again. And there's no place to hide at that point, because the whole world is going crazy. You know, Switzerland isn't gonna come through that well. They're a little tiny country in the middle of Europe. Latin America is already in chaos. Are you going to move your money to Brazil? I don't think so. Russia, China, would we invest in those countries if the U.S. is in chaos? I would think not. You know, so where do you go? That's going to be the big intellectual challenge of the next decade. Where do you hide when all this stuff blows up? Because it is going to blow up. We just don't know the timing, and we don't know the specifics, you know, the sequence of events which causes it to blow up.
John, many people have been frustrated with gold to a certain degree, maybe over the last few years. Maybe it's a matter of mismanaging their expectations. Not sure. Mismanaging my own expectations for gold. I would have thought gold would have been a lot higher by now. But you talked about the transfer of wealth from financialized assets to real assets. And maybe we'll start it off here. I mean, have we seen this in other times in history where gold has underperformed to a certain degree, where it's in theory on paper with what we know about gold's history should be going higher? And, you know, is this just another day in gold's history, where another time period that's similar to what we've seen in other times in history, which we should just have expected? Any thoughts on that?
I definitely thought it was going to be higher than it is right now at this time. Because if you look at the amount of debt that we're taking on, it continues to grow. And there was a long stretch where debt rose more or less in lockstep with, for instance, the U.S. government debt. And then the two diverged, with debt rising at an accelerating rate and gold just languishing. So probably two things have happened. One is when gold got up to $1,900 an ounce, it got ahead of itself. You know, it got beyond its fundamental value based on the paper in the world. And it had to languish for a while to catch back up. It's languished longer than I thought it would, though. And the other is that people aren't worried yet. As long as stocks and, to an extent, bonds go up, it doesn't spook the financial markets and it doesn't send a lot of terrified capital into safe havens. But you may have noticed, for instance, when stocks tanked, we had that flash crash towards the end of 2018, gold did pretty well. Because some of the money that people were pulling out of stocks when they were selling their stocks, they put into gold and silver. Now, it's likely that the same thing will happen, but on a bigger scale when things really get going. When things get crazy, the amount of paper wealth in the world compared to the amount of gold in the world is so immense that even a tiny fraction of investable funds out there flowing into gold and silver would send those markets to the moon. So as Jim Rickards says, yeah, you can wait until the crisis happens before you buy your gold, but by then you might not be able to get it. You know, it just might not be available. So I don't think there's really any choice for people who are who share your and my perspective and are worried about what's happening to the global financial system to buying gold now. You kind of have to have it to know you'll have it when the time comes. So probably the smartest thing to do now is dollar cost average. Buy a little bit each month and let it build up over time, so that when things really start to spin out of control, you'll at least have some. You know, you may not have as much as you would have liked to have had, but you'll have a position in precious metals. The alternative is to just go whole hog into it right now and accept losses if they come before the gains come. That's, you know, at this point, not a terrible idea, because I think we're running out of time for the financial system to tread water the way it is, and to continue to hold the illusion of prosperity. And that's really your only three options. Wait until the crisis and hope you can buy some then. Buy a bunch of it now and hope the intervening losses aren't too bad, or dollar cost average. I think for most people, you probably just want to kind of feather your way in and buy a little bit at a time and not really think about these day-to-day, week-to-week price movements, because otherwise they'll just drive you crazy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And getting in at the right price and then being happy with your position, there's a lot of peace of mind that comes with that. I mean, for a lot of people, you know, looking at the craziness of the crypto markets, you know, seeing it go from 3,000 to 4,000 and then saying, oh, well, wait, now I'll buy at three. You know, when at three, they weren't sure if it was going to 1,500. I mean, the psychology of what's going on with investing for someone who wanted to invest in crypto, but dealing with the fluctuations and then, you know, now kicking themselves, let's say, because it's at 8,000, because they were trying to, you know, play the market, you know, if you will, between three and four, and then dealing with the fluctuations, it can drive you mad in certain degrees. And then now 8,000, it feels like you're chasing it. You're like, okay, well now I'll wait. And then, you know, who knows what's going to happen, right? It could go to 20,000 and then, you know, you'll be wishing it was 8,000, or you can be buying at a high and it's going to go back to 4,000, right? So it's the craziness of the markets that we're dealing with. And I appreciate what you were saying about gold is, you know, getting in, getting your position and being comfortable with your situation, which I think is very good for people who want to own the asset. And you mentioned something in the pre-interview here about gold and gold's current situation, and something that might have investors optimistic in the short to midterm here. So I'd like to get to that if we can.
Sure. Well, gold has some short-term indicators that tend to work. And one is the structure of the financial or the futures markets. In other words, there are people who buy and sell and trade futures contracts in gold. And there are different groups within that market. And when one group is doing one thing and another group is doing another thing, that's the structure of the market. And it swings between the speculators who tend to be wrong at big turns, being long and short, for instance. We can leave aside the other people and just talk about the speculators for brevity here. But when the speculators are really excited and they're really long gold and silver tend to go down, because the speculators tend to get overexcited at the peak. And when they're really pessimistic, the opposite is true. It means most of the selling has been flushed out and there's only buying ahead for the next few months. Right now, it's not very favorable. The speculators are a little too optimistic in gold and silver. So that probably means another month or so for them to become pessimistic, either because the price does nothing or because the price goes down. Meanwhile, there's seasonality in the gold market, which you wouldn't think there would be because you can front run it, but still it happens every year this way. In Asia, they have their weddings in the spring and they love to give gold and silver jewelry as wedding gifts. So there's a lot of Asian buying towards the end of the year and very early in each year that push the price up. And there's no buying in the summer. So there's an old saying in the gold market, sell in May and go away. And part of the reason for that is that the Asians just aren't here right now. You know, they're not buying anything. So there's no upward pressure on the price. Now that also is unfavorable right now, but tends to become favorable in the next couple of months. So we're heading for a time, let's say in August, maybe July, when seasonality is starting to become favorable and the commitment of traders report, the structure of the futures market is also favorable. That's a good combination. So it means that in the last part of the year and the early part of 2020, the stars will be lined up for a nice move in gold and silver. Now that doesn't mean that move has legs. It just means it's a few months of really nicely rising prices, which is a good time to buy. So if you wanted to play those indicators, this would be a good time to buy, or over the next month or so would be a good time to buy, with the idea of selling in January or February. Now, that leaves aside the fundamentals, which are screamingly bullish for gold and silver. So you never want to zero out your position. You know, you want to hold a core precious metals position that you don't sell and you have no intention of selling until, you know, you see crazy prices like $10,000 an ounce for gold and $100 an ounce for silver. But beyond that core position, you can certainly trade these metals and do pretty well based on the indicators I just talked about.
Yeah. The last topic that I wanted to touch on, John, with you is the dynamic of crypto. I mean, $8,000 Bitcoin, the implications of the cryptocurrency in the 21st century, how it's going to change or not change the current financial markets, the implications on the global monetary system, the competition to the current monetary system, the competition to gold potentially. And what are your thoughts on what we're seeing here? You know, Bitcoin is not dead, as a lot of people might have thought it was going to happen, but you know, it's 8,000, and you know, my opinion, it shows its resilience in many ways. What are your thoughts here?
Well, I have no idea why Bitcoin bounces around the way it does. So I'm not a good source of information about whether you buy it or sell it here or anywhere. But I think the concept of cryptocurrencies is really interesting. You know, it's private sector money, and it's a piece of technology. So it can be improved exponentially the way technology improves, which means that as a medium of exchange, cryptocurrencies have a lot of advantages over today's credit cards, bank drafts, things like that. So they could have a place in tomorrow's monetary system. I think one thing that appeals to me emotionally is gold as the basis for the monetary system. In other words, the risk-free asset in the monetary system, and gold-based cryptos as the medium of exchange, because they're instantaneous, they're frictionless in theory. And gold is neither of those things. So if you could combine those two, you have the makings of a monetary system that has zero inflation and frictionless transactions. So I like the idea of it. But we have to see, as you said, it's a risk to the current global financial system. And no government, no central bank is going to give up the power to make currency out of thin air willingly. So the market, via some huge crisis, is probably going to have to take it away, take that power away. And that might be the thing that we need to be looking at. Like, rather than looking ahead at what the next monetary system is going to be, we should be looking at the crisis that will bring about the next monetary system and trying to figure out how to protect ourselves from it.
Those are powerful words. And yeah, definitely very interesting times as it pertains to the markets and the extremes that we've gone to get to where the current system is today. There was a couple of things I did want to get to, but you know, the time is slipping away here. We're going to have to continue this at another time. John Rubino of dollarcollapse.com. John, if people want to learn more about Dollar Collapse, please let them know where they can go and what they can expect to find.
I just visit the website. It's updated continuously. So the most recent news about the stuff we talked about today, at least in theory, is always there waiting for you to check out.
All right, John, thanks so much for coming on the show with me.
Thanks, Kenneth.